This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Ricky Montgomery is a multi-platinum independent musician, and you've either heard all about him on social media, or this is the first time you're hearing his name. The proud St. Louisan spends most of his time in Los Angeles. That's where his career led him, and where he landed a major record deal with Warner Music Group. And his work has gained him fans in the U.S. and across the world. The vulnerability of his songwriting is a big part of what resonates with listeners. It's a raw look into his life experiences, starting with his childhood, which is marked by tragedy, loss, heartbreak, and seeking a place of belonging. And this year marks the 10th anniversary of his debut album titled Montgomery Ricky. To celebrate, he's hitting the road for a three-city North American tour. It starts in St. Louis, where he spent his formative years, where the album was written and recorded, and where he got his first taste of internet stardom on Vine. Today, Ricky engages with millions of fans on TikTok and YouTube, and his biggest hits from his debut, Mr. Loverman and Line Without a Hook, have well over 880 million streams each. His St. Louis stop is tomorrow, March 26th at the Pageant. Ricky Montgomery recently sat down with producer Maya Norfleet to discuss the stories behind his viral hits and his experiences both as an indie artist and being signed to a major label. Ricky first reflected on the St. Louis venues where he cut his teeth before becoming a platinum musician.
Foo Bar was a new venue at the time. Mm-hmm. That would have been 08 or something, maybe 07, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, played just the worst songs imaginable at these little tiny shows in Foo Bar. I've played both stages at Foo Bar.
Okay.
And then I've probably to this day played that venue more than any other venue in my life, I think.
Ever?
I think so.
Oh, wow.
More times? Yeah, I think so. Cicero's, RIP.
Yes.
The Loop. Since then, I mean, I would just kind of do those. I would do a lot of open mics out here.
Mm-hmm.
SDLCC Wildwood Open Mic was my real stomping grounds. I'd go to that open mic, and I would always... They would make me the MC somehow every time I would go because my mom worked that she would kind of host the event.
Right.
And about an hour and a half into the event, you know, the sound guy would have to leave for some reason or my mom would get tired and they'd just give me the microphone. Then I'd just end up there like, all right, who's next? And so that was kind of like a real thing for me for a few years there. And Picasso's in St. Charles, I think.
Yeah.
Near the Lindenwood campus.
Okay. So, Ricky, your debut album, which was titled Montgomery Ricky, was released in 2016, and this year marks the 10-year anniversary of that debut. And on that project, you have two songs that I want to talk to you about, Mr. Loverman and Line Without a Hook. I want to start with Mr. Loverman first. Tell me about that song and what inspired it. I know it has something to do with your father.
Well, I started writing it in England. I did it through SCLCC, St. Louis Community College. I did a study abroad program there. I was just like around a lot of new music at the time. I had a friend who kind of like for the first time got me into the Beatles. I just never got there for some reason. And I was like, whoa, I get it now. You know, maybe just being in a new place was inspiring for me. And I just started writing these hooks about this song, Loverman, and I kind of wrote this chorus, which is like a little grammar wordplay kind of BS little experiment thing. And then I just kind of had it for a couple of years, and it didn't occur to me to kind of change the rest of the song about my dad, who was a closeted bi man, until a couple of years later. And then finally the song kind of came to me and unlocked itself. It's about other things in my life, too. But that was kind of... I don't know. It was exciting for me to write it about that. It was very cathartic. My dad was always a very kind of a rowdy boy, and lots of substance-y issues. And then, as I got older, and as I continue to get older now, I can relate to more of the things that he struggled with. And I was fresh into college, and I uh, he moved to Paris when he was 18, and I was like, I'm in Europe now too. Look at me.
Yeah.
I don't know, I was having a lot of parallel experiences, I guess.
I'm headed straight for the floor. The alcohol served its tour. And it's headed straight for my skin. Leaving me daft and dim. I've got this shake in my legs. Shaking the thoughts from my head. But who put these waves in the door? I crack and
The other song I want to ask you about, Ricky, is titled Line Without a Hook. I can interpret this myself, but of course you're sitting right here in front of me. Tell me about that song and what inspired it.
Well, that one's a bit more of like kind of a collage of meanings. That's sort of like my entire high school experience kind of crystallized into one song. I guess it's about being emotionally unbalanced and feeling codependent and having a lot of limerence problems being very rejection sensitive as a kid.
Mm.
Just trying to not, I guess struggling. I would have big emotional reactions to like being rejected, whether it was from an ex-girlfriend or a friend or so on. And I struggled with dealing with those emotions. Later, I found out I was just ADHD. I guess that's kind of broadly what that song is about, is my own kind of, why am I like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what that one's more so about. I was very surprised when that song blew up. I thought this was like a deep cut.
Oh.
I've said that before in other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, then one day it blew up and I went, oh, this one? All right.
I don't really give a damn about the way you touch me when we're alone. You can hold my hand if no one's home. Do you like it when I'm away? If I went and hurt my body, baby, would you love me the same? I can feel all my bones coming back and I'm craving motion. Mama never really learns how to live by herself. It's a curse and it's growing. You're a pond and I'm an ocean. Oh, all my emotions feel like explosions when you are around. And I found a way to kill the sound. Oh, baby, I am a wreck when I'm without you. I need you here. My bones that day I found you crying at the lake. Was it something I said to make you feel like you're a burden? Oh, and if I could take it all back, I swear that I would pull you from the tide.
Again, your album, your debut album, Montgomery Ricky, was released in 2016, but it was in 2020 where it started to pick up a lot of traction. Why is that? What was going on in 2020 in your world for this project to get so much, to pick up so much steam?
First of all, I the boring truth is that it was already kind of bubbling up with this game called OSU. It's like a Dance Dance Revolution type of game.
Okay.
That's on the internet. It's a little, instead of your feet, it's a mouse. So you click to the beat. And I've seen it. It's actually very interesting to watch.
It's people. A rhythm game.
It's a rhythm game. And for whatever reason, the songs just like really snapped with that game. And that's sort of an anime community adjacent game. And the next year, first of all, that company reached out to me. And then I later, my first licensing deal ever was with that company. And at the time, they were like, we'll give you $300 per song. And I was like, $500 per song. And they were like, cool. And I was like, whoa, what a rush. And so I thought, man, I'm swimming in it. $5,000? Well, I've never seen this much money before. Then the next year, it kind of catalyzed into the same type of genre of community online. And so, I mean, my best guess is that people were sad that year for reasons that obviously we understand.
Yeah, COVID shutdown, loss of employment, people lost loved ones.
Yeah. So it was about this time of year in 2020 when all that was really beginning to happen. And so everything you just said. And also boredom. And
in the house
frustration so I guess, you know, kind of right place, right time, also I think there was a big nostalgia wave that year of you know, no one had anything going on, and so the songs had already been out for about 4 years at that point, and so I had already had sort of a generation of fans that were for me from the Vine era. I had a big Vine following, which I did all out here. I was the biggest viner in St. Louis at the time.
Really?
I think so. I believe.
I'm gonna have to do some. I'm a fact check.
Now there might be. I'll be honest. The only community that I was never able to pierce was the black comedy scene on Vine. And so I'm gonna say, it's possible.
Sorry.
Because I never know where these folks are from.
You right? Yeah.
So that would be the only. If you find somebody in that scene, I'll acknowledge that could be possible.
Okay.
But otherwise. Nostalgia from a lot of people, and then, you know, at the time TikTok was just giving out algorithm gas like it was, you know, going out of business, and so I think just they were just, you know, hitting boost on everybody, and I just happens to be, like I said, like kind of in the correct intersection for me to get all that, and then finally put out a music video for the song you mentioned, Mr. Lover Man, and I put it out by total mistake. On the day of the election, Biden v. Trump, there was nothing happening on YouTube that day, incidentally. And so we were almost like in the top five charting videos on YouTube for like entire day. And so the video like went crazy. And then that catalyzed into another song of mine going viral at the same time. We called Line Without a Hook. And then I had two going viral at the same time. And then everybody's label, their mom, their aunts, their uncles, they came to my house. And then I later signed. So that's kind of a lot of dumb luck mistakes that I later pretended were on purpose. I had a meeting with like the CEO of Warner the day after that, and he said, "We never would have thought. What's amazing, man? So smart." And I was like,
"You know what?
Well, you know, if you assign me." And then they did.
I feel like once I get past like the catchy like tune of it. I'm like, I'm listening to this man's, like, journal entries.
Thank you.
And I think that is also part of why it seems like your fans really, it's not just, like, a parasocial relationship. Like, it seems like they truly care about you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you just mentioned, you know, most likely possibly being one of the biggest Vine stars in the St. Louis area at that time. Has that always just been part of your... Really, which one is it? Is the social media, comfort around social media, just like who you are, or is that something that you learn to grow as a music entrepreneur?
I think I, maybe like you, feel very native to digital. I feel like I still have a little bit of that kind of naive optimism. I think from that, I don't know. I just feel like I'm, the internet is a smaller town than you might than it really is. Sometimes it feels like a smaller town than it is sometimes. And I still kind of feel like I'm embodying that kind of like early Facebook kind of neighborliness. I don't know. I'm always so grateful for anybody paying any attention. And I don't know how to not act like everybody in my comments knows me personally. And so I do take negative comments, that being said, much more harshly than I should sometimes.
Okay.
Well, not that I crash out or anything.
Sure.
But I don't know. I think all those things. And then also, I don't know. I think I'm also aware that at my shows, when I started playing shows in L.A. under my solo artist name, out here I was in bands, but when I moved to L.A., I was beginning to kind of launch the solo career. All my fans in the crowd were like either trans or they were usually like neurodivergent or some sort of minority group that's oppressed and so on. And so I guess that I really tried to handle that responsibly. I also didn't, and still kind of, I do more now, but I didn't really understand why that was the case for my fans at the time. Also, some sort of, I don't know what this phenomenon is, but I have a huge Southeast Asian audience.
I noticed, I was like, this is a global, like, I was looking at the, on Spotify specifically, how it says, like, discovered on, and, like, all the different playlists that your song, or, you know, your songs, your music appear on. And it is, I saw, like, a lot of, like, Filipino and, like, Indonesian. I'm like,
in Malaysia.
Yes.
And, Singapore. We played Singapore a couple of years ago, finally. Yeah, no, exactly. Jakarta is like a bigger city than LA for me internationally, and Manila as well, and India is a big one now too. And I guess with the international thing, when you have, my main issue as an artist is that my songs are bigger than me. And so it's a difficult, you know, threshold to cross. And so I think what I try to always ask myself is, how is this content that I'm making or this thing I'm saying or so on and so forth going to translate across a cultural gap that's not only like, you know, a language barrier, but also like Eastern, Western, global South, et cetera. You know, how will I be interpreted in a country that has no connection to me culturally? And so I think that the only response I can ever really muster for that is like, I'll just try to be nice.
That was Ricky Montgomery, a multi-platinum independent singer-songwriter from St. Louis, in conversation with St. Louis on the Air producer Maya Norfleet. They discussed the stories behind two of his biggest hits, Mr. Loverman and Line Without a Hook, ahead of Ricky's tour stop in St. Louis, which is tomorrow, March 26th, at the Pageant. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to producer Maya Norfleet and her conversation with multi-platinum singer-songwriter Ricky Montgomery. He returned to St. Louis ahead of a tour that celebrates the 10-year anniversary of his multi-platinum debut album, Montgomery Ricky, which has garnered him fans in the U.S. and across the world. Maya continued her conversation with Ricky, who talked about more recent music that touches on the death of his father. A content warning: the following exchange includes themes of grief, mental illness, and suicide. Here's Maya.
So about 2 years ago, you released an album titled Ricky, and on it is another song that's inspired by your dad. It's called Black Fin, inspired by a very sensitive subject around your father. So I want to hear about that directly from you as well, if you could tell me more about Black Fin.
Oh, thank you. Wow, yeah. The song's called Black Fins, which I only clarify because it's about, it's this image that I will never be able to remove from my mind, which is these two flippers, you know, swimming flippers for feet. So it's a reference to that and, you know, trying to, you know, kind of embody it as like a sort of an aquatic image. And basically, it's a reference to my father's passing. He passed, I'm not on TikTok, so I can say suicide. Mm-hmm. He was always very, as I kind of have alluded to, unbalanced in everything, struggled with all sorts of things. And we suspect bipolarity was one of those things, or bipolar disorder, rather. For the first time, he was going to come to St. Louis. He was in a Schnucks parking lot on Christmas morning. And we were supposed to, we had some miscommunication with him where he was going to meet up with us that day. We were all very excited because he had never come here before. But then I get a call from him on Christmas, which is always the best day for everybody, you know. We were apparently a day late. He'd been waiting for 24 hours, he said, in this parking lot, just sitting in his car. Anyways, so he just left, kind of rage quit the vacation. And I tried to apologize to him. I was 15 at the time. And so he left. And then just was in Mexico. Then he died. And we didn't find out that until a few weeks later, probably the end of January. He just washed up on a beach in the sea, what they call the Sea of Cortez. I forget what Americans call it, but it's between Baja California and sort of the mainland of Mexico. Yeah, so we don't really know what happened. I know it was a suicide because when I got back to LA to clear out my belongings from my childhood home, where he lived, his house was foreclosed on. He had stopped paying his mortgage, and it was 2008. So, as you can imagine, not an irrelevant timeline. We were cleaning out the house because it was being repossessed by the bank. I found a pad of paper that was just sitting on his desk, beautifully sort of organized, which was. My dad was a bit of a hoarder, which was very, not in his character to have, like, this very neat desk. So I was immediately suspicious. and there was this blank yellow pad of notes. And I picked it up, and I remember as I picked it up, the pages fell forward. And then I saw that every other page, except for the first three in the front, were totally filled out. And my aunt came in the room as I began to read it. It was a suicide letter, and she said, "You can't read that now until you're older." And I said, "Okay, totally." And then she left, and I went to my mom and said, "Mom, here's the deal: we got to get this pad of paper." And she explained the situation to her. And then later that next day, I broke into my own house. I've never told this story. When I was 15. We had this little, like, cat thing. Like, we had a modified screen window with a latch on it. And I pulled myself up through this little latch hatch in our kitchen window, broke into my own house, stole my dad's suicide letters, went with my mom to my old elementary school where they had a Xerox machine. My mom used to work there as a teacher, so they let us do this. And I just sat there reading just an oppressive number of notes. and just literally made copies and read it all in my old elementary school. And I broke back into my house, put it back, and then left.
Would you leave those kids again and kick them out of town?
One last thing. You've touched on a very... I've never gotten to talk about this before. I later did the video with Warner. And you know what, y'all? Boy, does a giant mega corporation not know how to handle trauma. Oh, boy. And, you know, the whole video got just absolutely manhandled. They wanted to shoot it in a mansion for some reason. And then I found out that we shot it in the wrong location. I did for years thought my dad died in Cabo. My mom told me the day after that she sent me his death certificate. And I was so mad.
Yeah.
And so I went back a week later. This is the part I never told anybody. I went back alone a week later to the same place. And he died about 2.5 hours inland in the middle of the desert off the coast of Mexico there. And I drove alone to where he died. And I went to this little B&B in the middle of nowhere. It was all dirt roads. I lost GPS access, but I was like just manically obsessed with finding this location because I just spent $70,000 on this video. Mm. I did actually find the place where he died. And in fact, when I got there, I had practiced like this whole Spanish thing. Like my dad was swimming here in 2009 and he died here. Can I go to the beach and take pictures? I walk in. And there's this lady there. She walks out, and I say, hola. And she says, hello. And she's this lady from Boston, this white lady from Boston, speaks perfect English. And I explain the situation, and she's white as a ghost as I explain this to her. And she says, I was there.
Oh, wow.
And she says, I'll go grab my husband. He actually found your dad's body. We're going to go show you where it was. So I was like, okay. I was going to throw up. Then, yeah, they drove me down to that place where it all happened and everything. And, one of the most surreal moments of my whole life. And then I drove back to the airport and came home.
You just released another single, Oh My My, mm-hmm. on March 12th. And you said on social media that it's connected to Line Without a Hook.
Mm-hmm.
Why continue that through line? From music that you wrote so long ago?
Good question. So we're doing a lot of stuff for this 10-year anniversary. And Oh My My was a song I totally forgot about. I was listening to it and I was like, oh yeah, I took the verse from this song and made it into Line Without a Hook. I forgot about all that. And I just reproduced the entire thing top to bottom. We retracked everything in the whole song. And it's, so much better now. Oh, my goodness. I just thought that'd be interesting for people to know because obviously it's my biggest song, is Line Without a Hook. It's got 890 million streams.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured there might be some built-in interest in like a sort of a previous version of the song. And so far that seems to be bearing out.
What makes it so much better now?
Well, the I made it like an acoustic version like 10 years ago. No, actually, 14 years ago. Mm. I wrote it, when I was 18. And, I didn't change the lyrics because I wanted to be honest about the thing. But I was a way worse singer. And I've got a good coach now, Dave Stroud. I don't know. I'm better. We're just better. Yeah, that's the short answer.
It comes with time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The smell on my breath is just a distraction. This is how I should be. And somewhere, someday, you'll see. You'll see what I can be.
That was multi-platinum singer-songwriter Ricky Montgomery in conversation with St. Louis on the Air producer Maya Norfleet. Ricky Montgomery kicks off his limited North American tour, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the release of his debut album, Montgomery Ricky. His concert is tomorrow, March 26th at The Pageant. Ticket information can be found at thepageant.com.
This episode was produced, recorded, and edited by Maya Norfleet.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.